remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is April 1st, 2022. This meeting is held in accordance of Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Vice Chair Wasilewicz.
Wasilewicz present.
Representative Heinzman and Representative Green will be joining us a bit later. Representative Acom.
Present.
Representative Ackland.
Present.
Representative Backer. Representative Backer. Representative Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Ackland. Representative Ackland. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Igo.
Igo, present.
Representative Jordan.
Jordan, present.
Representative Keeler.
Keeler, present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert, present.
Representative Lewick.
Lewick, present.
Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Tice.
Tice, present.
All right. Thank you.
Quorum is present. As I mentioned yesterday, we have to move the minutes for March 29th again because there was an error. Representative Heinzman, you moved the minutes yesterday. Are you here? I'll move the minutes. Seeing Representative Wasilewicz, do you want to move the minutes for March 29, 2022?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wasilewicz moves the minutes for March 29, 2022. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes for March 29th are approved. Next up, Representative Fisher, would you like to move the minutes for March 31st, 2022?
Yes, Chair Hansen. I'd like to move the minutes from March 31st, 2022 for approval.
Representative Fisher moves the minutes from March 31st, 2022. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The minutes are approved. Next up, we have House File 3146. Members, we have a lot of bills today, and we have to do a couple of motions to conduct the business. And first up, with Representative Lee, before he moves his bill, he actually would like to have one of the people speaking or both of them to speak before the bill is moved. Is that correct, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. I want to have Professors Jason Hill and Dylan Nillitz from the University of Minnesota to come and talk about some of their research first before I proceed with my bill, because I have asked them to come and talk about the issues of pollution in general and not to my particular bill, Mr. Chair.
So members, we will provide 10 minutes for Mr. Hill and Dr. Hill and Dr. Millett. So Dr. Hill, if you could introduce yourself and who you're with for the record, and also Dr. Millett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Dr. Millett is going to go first.
Okay.
Hello. So, yeah. Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to share
just,
my screen.
State your name and who you're with for the record.
I'm Professor Dylan Millet at University of Minnesota.
Welcome. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you see my PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, so thank you for the opportunity. We're here to talk a little bit or give some context on air pollution and some of our research related to air pollution exposure and exposure disparities that Professor Hill and myself have been involved with. So I'll just go ahead and get right started. I wanted to start off by motivating with the fact to point out to make sure we all understand that air pollution is a major public health issue and also one of the leading causes of mortality globally and in the U.S. And so this is some data from a study that comes out periodically called the Global Burden of Disease. And what it's showing is deaths in millions of people due to different causes. And we see some familiar things like alcohol use, high body mass index, tobacco, and this is globally all ages. But number four on this list is air pollution. And so we have an estimated over 6 million premature deaths every year to air pollution. So this is a significant public health issue that we need to pay attention to. It's a large number compared to, for example, things that we might think of more readily as being causes of death worldwide, such as HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis. So in the U.S., we have, we're fortunate to have cleaner air than in many other countries, but it's still the case that air pollution is still one of the leading causes of illness and death. And so here it is for the, here's the same statistics for the U.S. And it's that the most recent estimates are that we have over 60,000 premature deaths every year from air pollution, compared to, for example, in 2019, we had 36,000 traffic deaths. So again, just making the point that this is an issue that we should be paying attention to. It's also the case that all our exposure to this air pollution is not the same for everybody. So depending on where you live, you're exposed to more or less air pollution. That's apparent in this map of nitrogen dioxide, which is a traffic-related air pollutant. So depending on where you live, you're going to be breathing more or less of this air pollutant between cities, but also within cities. And so this map on the bottom is from some research that I was involved with a few years ago, mapping out the spatial distribution of nitrogen dioxide air pollution for different cities in the U.S. And I'm just showing here Los Angeles and New York, but you can see depending on where you are within those cities, you're going to be breathing much higher or much lower amounts of air pollution. And so because of those spatial disparities, that means that there's a large body of research that's demonstrated quite clearly that we have disparities in terms of demographics and race in terms of how we're exposed to air pollution. And specifically, within the U.S., non-white populations are exposed to significantly more air pollution than white populations. So that's what this graph is showing here for NO2 air pollution. Percent non-white in the census group on the x-axis. And you can see there's two things to see on this. One is that you have data from year 2000 and 2010. So things have been improving. We've been improving our air quality, but these disparities are still persisting. And one thing that you might initially think is that it's tied to income, but actually these disparities in terms of air pollution exposure, we see are much larger by race than they are by income. So we see for income on the right, we see relatively small differences by income compared to the differences we see by race. And the darker colors here are for the earlier year, and the lighter colors are for the later year. So we do see the same improvement over time, but with the disparities persisting. And actually, the disparities in air pollution exposure are within the U.S. are actually greater than they are for income itself. And then lastly, I'm going to hand things over to Professor Hill here, but I want to make the point before I end that we have these differences in air pollution exposure that are tied to where people live within cities, and there's various sort of fine scale differences in air pollution concentration. But our ability to describe those and to predict how or understand how they're getting better or worse is limited by the fact that we have the limited number of measurements to map those air pollutants. So I'm just illustrating over on top here the two different monitoring network from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and they're doing a great job. This is better than most cities, but you can see compared to the scale over which the air pollution concentrations are varying, the number of monitors is quite sparse. It makes it a challenge to really map these disparities well. So I'll hand it over to Professor Hill, and I'll move the slides for you when you tell me to move them.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm Jason Hill, professor in the Department of Bioproducts and Biosystems Engineering at the University of Minnesota. I'm speaking on my own behalf today and do not represent the official views of the University of Minnesota. The work that I'm going to be describing is funded by state and federal support. It is not funded by any particular special interests. Thank you very much for having me here to speak to you today about this issue. So as Professor Millay indicated, the number of deaths from poor air quality in the United States each year are substantial. Recent work that my group and others have done have suggested, you know, around 100,000 deaths per year. There are some differences in how the accounting is done and how deaths are attributed to air pollution. But these deaths are substantial. Many of the graphs that I'm going to show you, a warning, there's a lot going on in them, but I urge you to sort of defocus your eyes a little bit and appreciate the overall picture that I'll talk you through. And the thing to notice from this graph is when we do these accountings, we realize that air pollution is not caused by just one source. It's not just power plants. It's not just transportation. It's also agriculture. It's residential energy use and so forth. And it's not just one pollutant. It's primary fine particulate matter, dust, soot, for instance, behind a dirty diesel bus. It's also ammonia that's released from agricultural production that forms secondary fine particulate matter. All sorts of sources. Only about half of all deaths in the U.S. from poor air quality are due to fossil fuels. There are other sources as well. Next slide, please. I'm going to just show you a few of the applications from this. One of the things that we've worked on, in particular here in Minnesota, is understand the air quality impacts of agriculture. The sort of accounting methods we have allow us to attribute these deaths to certain sectors of the economy. This is a story from last year from the Washington Post covering this work. Next slide, please. We've also been able to get overall economy-wide understanding, an overall economy-wide understanding of what sectors are responsible for these deaths, and ultimately tie it to the specific demand, the use. One of the things that we've had access to, that everybody has access to, is the US EPA's National Emissions Inventory, which is an accounting of all these different pollutants that contribute to poor air quality in the US. And we've been able to use new tools that I'll describe very briefly at the end of this talk that, that allow us to rapidly assess the impact from all of these sources. So we get this overall picture that then allows us to do some work in relation to environmental justice. Next slide, please. These are some findings from our work on the environmental justice side. The air quality has gotten better for everybody. Nevertheless, you can see here all the way on the right, looking at these different trends, the pollution inequity, the disparity in exposure and contribution to the problem experienced by different racial ethnic groups has persisted over time. Even though air quality has gotten better, these disparities have persisted. Next slide, please. The work that I'm going to focus on for the rest of my talk here is on one specific paper. It's a paper we published last year in Science Advances titled PM2.5 Polluters Disproportionately and Systemically, that word is key here, Affect People of Color in the United States. So the work that we did before helped us understand what sectors of the economy were contributing to the overall problem, to understand that people of color were disproportionately impacted by pollution. But we needed to tie this together to understand what sectors of the economy are responsible. Is this a state by, are there some states where this is a problem and other states where it's not? Is it a rural-urban divide? Is it due to income? We need to understand the problem better if we're going to start proposing solutions to it. So that's what this paper was, a deep dive into the this issue of environmental justice with relation to the specific distribution of inequity in the United States. Next slide, please. So this is, again, one of those figures where I encourage you to sort of defocus your eyes a little bit and just look at the overall picture. What you see here is the disproportionate impact on the top left is by state, top right is within urban areas, bottom left is in rural areas, and bottom right is by income level. And what you notice is that moving sort of left to right on each of these figures is different levels of exposure of different racial ethnic groups. So either white, which is in green points, or people of color, which is in purple. And when you move top to bottom, what you're seeing is the relative contribution of different sources to the problem. So if everything were experienced, if pollution and neck exposure were was experienced the same in all cases by all people, there would just be a single point on this graph. The further you move away from those center points, the sort of bigger the disparities you see are. And you probably see some trends here, right? You see overall there's green on the lower half of the graphs and purple on the higher. And what you're seeing here is this disparity. And what this is showing you is that whether you look at the problem by state, by urban, by rural, by income level, you have this inequity in exposure and inequity in the sources of pollution that are contributing to that exposure. What I've circled here in blue or red are Minnesota. And what you see in each case is that that overall trend that we observe also holds in Minnesota. So Minnesota is not an exception to this overall observation on a national level that there is this disproportionate exposure and to pollution. Next slide, please. I'll just wrap this up quickly. It's also an economy-wide problem. There's no one sector of the economy that's driving this. And so overall, what you notice is that there is this, whether you're looking at industrial, construction, commercial cooking, residential, there is this overall disproportionate impact. Now, there are a couple sectors that buck this trend a little bit, agriculture and coal electric utility. And when you dig into the specific groups listed, classified as people of color, you see that there are some differences there as well. Blacks disproportionately across the board by every sector of the economy negatively affected by fine particulate matter pollution from these different sectors. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. I'll just skip this one here in the interest of time. Finally, I want to mention that the model that we use to do this work in MAP actually arose from a collaboration between me, Julie Marshall, and a graduate student at the time, Chris Tessum, from a project that was, next slide, please. Final slide here, was funded by the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, which was funding from the Minnesota legislature specifically to look at issues related to renewable energy. So I just wanted to give you some perspective here that this work is an outgrowth of a collaboration that was seeded by State of Minnesota money specifically to explore these issues. So thank you very much for your support, and I hope this has shown you what that sort of seed can grow into. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hill and Dr. Millay. It's important to have academic freedom and to have unbiased sources of funding. Thank you for your presentations. Representative Lee, will you move that House File 3146 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Representative Lee also has an author's amendment. Representative Lee, would you move the A4 amendment and explain your amendment briefly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A4 amendment, which is an amendment to move towards addressing some of the air toxics issues that was identified from the Office of the Legislative Auditor's Water Gremlin Report last year, requiring air toxic rulemaking and air toxic emission reporting. Also, the amendment also have funding in there for community local air quality monitoring projects so that communities could actually use some of the data that's collected to develop strategies to reduce pollution in their communities, and also have additional funding for air monitoring devices for the Pollution Control Agency. These are, all initiatives that I'm bringing forward myself, not from the agency or anyone, Mr. Chair, other than from my conversations with the community members that I have in my district and from across the state.
You, Representative Lee, are there any questions to the A4 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 3146 as amended. House File 3146, as amended, is an updated version of the cumulative impacts bill that I introduced earlier. This is by UNM House File 168. Most of the content of the bill was included in the Senate File 959, which was a 2021 House Omnibus Finance Bill. Mr. Chair, I'll move to those particular pieces that have changed from the first bill. So I have had heard from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agencies and, you know, took into some consideration some of the feedback, you know, naming around using census tracts to define what is environmental justice area instead of census block, and also requiring the MPCA and other state agencies to develop a list of sources for each of the pieces of data that's used in the required demographic analysis in the bill that speaks to the community member sensitivity to incremental pollution. I put in the words saying that if the data is available, that they should provide that to folks who are applying for these permits. Other changes that I incorporated based on the feedback that I have heard from many community members is to add the definition of environmental justice, and also requiring public comments to be part of the record on which a permit decision is issued, and requiring the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to post an environmental justice map according to the areas defined in the bill. And to Mr. Chair, to the amendment that we just adopted, you know, it was concerning for me reading in the report that, you know, in 1985, the MPCA started to include air toxins provisions in some of their air quality permits as issue, but this was on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, in the report, they said that, you know, today, in 2021, 30 years later, there are still no Minnesota rules governing air toxics. And so I think that was one of the reasons why I proposed to add on air toxics rulemaking and the emissions reporting in there. And then, you know, just going back to what I had said earlier around the local community air monitoring project, you know, many members from my district, representing Jordan's district and across the area, have reached out on what can we do to help local communities, you know, develop strategies. And I think this is a path forward for doing that. And so, Mr. Chair, House File 31, as amended, requires the MPCA to analyze and consider the cumulative levels and effects of past and current environmental pollution on the environment and residents of an environmental justice area before issuing, renewing, or approving a major amendment to a facility permit. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to, I think we have some public testifier.
Yes, Representative Lee, we have Dr. Greg Pratt.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Pratt was invited guest of mine to come and talk about some of the technical pieces to the bill and also to the rulemaking piece. He was instrumental in helping me draft some of that language.
Dr. Pratt, welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. My name is Greg Pratt. I worked for 32 years for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on air quality issues, retiring from the agency in 2016. Since 1999, I've been a faculty member in the Environmental Health Sciences Division in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, and my expertise is in the field of air pollution. I have worked on and published scientific papers on the sources of air pollution, air pollution levels, the movement of air pollution in the atmosphere, human exposure to air pollution and its effects on health, and the socioeconomic impacts of air pollution. And most recently, I've been consulting for the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences to examine exposure and health effects for workers who were involved in the response and cleanup following the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. The views I'll express today are my own, and they do not necessarily reflect the positions of organizations with which I am now or have previously been affiliated. So Representative Lee asked me to take a look at his proposal and give my opinion. On this proposal that would require reporting of toxic air emissions and the evaluation of community status in siting a facility, I strongly approve of this measure. Representative Lee alluded to the history going back into the 1980s when air toxics rules were under consideration. I was at the agency at that time, and I'm very familiar with that history. So we prepared to promulgate rules that would have included, among other things, a reporting of emissions. But that effort was abandoned in favor of a voluntary approach. So what has come to be the case in practice is that many permittees do a very good job and report their emissions accurately, their air toxics emissions. However, unfortunately, that outcome is not ubiquitous. Many facilities either do not report or do not report accurately. And in those cases, MPCA must estimate the emissions based upon the available information, which is sometimes incomplete. And this lack of reliable information leads to an inaccurate assessment of the potential health impacts from air pollution and a lack of complete information on the parties that are responsible for the impacts that we see. And I want to thank the two previous speakers for their input and their work on this issue. It jives, agrees very closely with what I have found in my work as well. So thank you for that. I have also studied the socioeconomic impacts of air pollution and found that in the past and continuing until now, roadways and polluting industries have been located disproportionately in the neighborhoods with high proportion of people of color and low socioeconomic status. We know, and I have published studies showing this in Minnesota, that such communities have higher air pollution levels and more adverse health effects as a result. So in my opinion, it is past time to address and rectify these environmental injustices. And this bill, this proposal is one step forward in doing that. Until recently, the idea that one could put pollution into the air without regard for the consequences was not questioned. But things have changed. We all want the right to breathe clean and healthy air. And so there's a concept that has gained traction called chemical trespass. It asks the question, by what right did your air pollution find its way into my body? So in order to answer that question, and we see that air pollution does affect people. It does get into their bodies. It does cause health effects. And so in order to answer the question of who's doing it and how we can address it, we need to know what chemicals are being emitted and how much and by whom. And the bill under consideration addresses that concern. So for these and other reasons, I support the proposal by Representative Lee and his colleagues. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before the committee.
Thank you. Next up, Sherilyn A. Young, St. Paul community member. Welcome to the committee and state your name.
Thank you. My name is Sherilyn Young and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am very, very excited to see this issue addressed today. It's a dream come true for me. I live in St. Paul, just south of the downtown area on the west side of the Mississippi River. And I grew up just downriver from there on the Mississippi, across from the St. Paul Park oil refinery in Inverroad Heights. That's where I lived. And both are places with major sources of air pollution. And I wonder how this will affect me as I age and continue to live in the neighborhood and the location where I grew up. I support this House File 3146 because it proposes a common sense way to make decisions about locating industry. That is by first evaluating the pre-existing conditions of both the natural environment and human health, and then using that information to make decisions about siting new industry. I first realized the need for this kind of analysis in the 90s. Some of you are as old as me and will remember that there were proposals to build metal shredders on the river in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. And me and my neighbors didn't really know what that would entail, but we learned that the feed source, which is cars, would be their main source of metal that they were shredding. They would emit heavy metals like mercury and cadmium, as well as particulate matter. And then the additional truck traffic at the facility by hauling the cars there would mean additional air pollution. And all this in a place in St. Paul with pre-existing conditions, including centuries-old garbage dump, which leach runoff into the water, like Pig's Eye and Lilydale. And I don't mean multiple centuries. I mean one century. Sorry about that. Scrap yards that contaminate the soil, a coal-burning power plant that spews black soot, and a wastewater treatment facility, which eliminates high levels of mercury. All these are pre-existing conditions that also coexist with St. Paul's airport, and we're also near the intersection of Interstates 94 and 35E, which is one of the areas with the most air pollution in Minnesota. So the people that live here in this area are well known as immigrants. It's a place where people come to back a century ago. People come to live here because they can afford the housing here. And then I've chosen to stay because it's a great neighborhood with a lot of amenities and close by certain things. Nearest where I live and nearest the site for this proposed metal shredder back in the 90s are long existing communities of color, and more than half of the neighborhood are renters. Our land has bluffs with rivers, the river and eagles and the heron rookeries. And just to remind you, while St. Paul did not allow the metal shredding facility to be built, Minneapolis did allow Northern Metals activities. And I'm sure that Representative Lee knows the neighborhood and the city are dealing with air pollution from that site to this day. And with this bill back in place then, these harms could have prevented. Permitting pollution from industrial and waste facilities as if they were standing in a pristine environment just doesn't make sense. Like considering a person's pre-existing conditions when we consider the effect the illness from the SARS-CoV-2 virus would have on them is something we need to do with our environment as we consider permitting facilities. We need to evaluate what contaminants are already there and if already vulnerable people will be further impacted. We live in, just a word of encouragement, I guess, we live in a history with the history of environmental development and the history of the development of the state of Minnesota here in my area and the impact of past decisions that we did not have a say in. We can't change the past, but we can be responsible for the future. We can consider the pollution that already exists and the health and the vulnerability of the people nearby before we make new decisions. Neighborhoods and cities, like people, come with pre-existing conditions, and it makes sense to consider that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome and state your name.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of comments this morning on House File 3146. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to start off with just a general comment of our environmental permitting and environmental review process here in Minnesota. And the three concerns I hear consistently from our members is that the process right now takes too much time, costs too much, and causes uncertainty in the process. And so, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point that out. And unfortunately, I think House File 3146 adds to all of those concerns. And before I start going through 3146, Mr. Chairman, I also wanted to point out that according to the Air That We Breathe report that just came out, when we talk about air toxics, permitted sources, including power plants and factories, are responsible for 22% of our air emissions in the state. Off-road vehicles are 21%. Non-permitted sources, including small businesses or heating and wood smoke, are 33%. And on-road vehicles or cars and trucks are 24%. So for permitted sources, we're talking about 22% of our air emissions in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, in regards to the House File 3146, in the definition of environmental justice, we just want to clarify so that we don't get in conflict with and cause uncertainty with the federal definition of environmental justice. And there are some differences there between the federal definition and the state definition. So we'd like to see those clarified, Mr. Chairman, if we could. Also, to talk about the scope of what we're talking about here in regards to House File 3146, under the environmental justice area and the criteria there that are set up, it is a large percentage of the state of Minnesota, including all of our major regional centers. And we're just wondering how that also works in coordination with the EPA EJ screen, Mr. Chairman. In Section 5, there are a couple of terms in there that we cannot find definitions for in statute, Mr. Chairman. If you look at 4.6, where it talks about the permit action sought is likely to, and also on 4.10, where it talks about based on the permit application is projected impacts, those aren't defined in statute. So we're trying to figure out how those would fit into the for the permit applicant. Also, Representative Lee referenced that the data that's going to be included now by the permit applicant, we need to know whether some of that data might include trade secrets and proprietary information, and if that data is going to be protected or not before it gets published to the public, and whether all of it's going to be published or some of it. So we'd like to work that out. Also, when I talked about the context of what this is going to affect, that it's largely statewide and regional centers, it's also in all the effective date sections. If you'll notice, it talks about new permits, it talks about major permit amendments, but it also includes permit renewals or simple reissuances of permits for non-controversial projects will now be required to all of these requirements that are in this bill. In Section 6, Mr. Chairman, where we set up the demographic analysis and the 15 new requirements for permit applicants, it talks about that the permit applicant must provide the information if available, and then the commissioner with the State Demographic Center, Department of Health, and other state agencies must apply those to the permit applicant. So we're trying to get some clarity there of if available and how it's applied to the permit applicant. Also, if we could work on some sort of agreed upon framework on how all of these 15 new requirements are going to be submitted to the agency, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the environmental justice areas, there is an appeal process set up there, but there's no criteria on how that appeal process is going to work, and how the criteria, once they are determined, how they're going to be set. And so we'd like to work on trying to figure out on how that appeal process would work for the citizens as well as for permit applicants on the environmental justice areas. Finally, Mr. Chairman, on Section 9 of House File 3146, it's going to add that section 116D04 is the environmental impact statement section, Mr. Chairman. And you'll see it says environmental assessment worksheets and environmental impact statements now are now going to all have to include those demographic analysis that those 15 requirements now that I asked about the framework before, those are now going to be included into environmental assessment impact statements and worksheets. In regards to the A4, right now, Mr. Chairman, the air toxics emission inventory is done every 3 years. And if you look at the data over the last 20 years, is there a reason that we need to increase the frequency? So we're just curious if there's something there we need to focus on. Is there something that jumps out of that data? Also, the EPA uses that data for the national air toxics assessments. Is there something in those national air toxics assessments that show a year-to-year variability that we need to focus on and that is requiring extra data? So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I'll stick around for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Craig McDonald, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Craig McDonnell, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in House File 3146 as amended. The MPCA's mission is to protect and improve the environment and human health. In order for us to achieve our mission, the agency must continue to focus on reducing the disproportionate impacts pollution has on Minnesota's Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and low to moderate income residents. As an agency, we know there is much work to do on this front, and we are supportive of the intent of this bill and share the author's goal of addressing environmental inequalities. The data is clear. While Minnesota is currently meeting federal clean air standards, air pollution continues to pose a threat to public health in Minnesota, with the impacts falling disproportionately on community whose residents may have lower incomes and have higher proportions of people of color. Black, Indigenous, and people of color and low-income residents are more likely to live near sources of air pollution from facilities, as well as from transportation and neighborhood sources. Statewide, about 51% of Minnesotans experience air pollution risks above a health risk guideline. For low-income areas of the state, that number rises to 66%. And for communities of color and Indigenous communities in Minnesota, 93% experience air pollution risks above a health risk guideline. The MPCA believes that the mandatory reporting of air toxics is a prudent step that will allow the agency to better understand the total picture of air pollution and how air pollution is impacting environmental justice communities of concern. The agency also appreciates the goals of the Community Air Monitoring Grant Program. Working with communities so local people and organizations can collect data in their neighborhood and then translate that data into local knowledge can lead to innovative efforts to reduce air pollution from neighborhood sources, mobile sources, and facilities. Mr. Chair, as I stated earlier, we support the intent of this bill and want to work with the author and the communities most impacted by pollution to help implement their ideas successfully. For instance, we think there are opportunities to scope this work to bring down the implementation costs and to initially focus some of this work on a subset of permittees whose emissions may be larger or who may pose a greater risk to human health and the environment. We also think there's an opportunity to scope this bill to avoid unintended consequences, such as a situation where a positive addition to the community, like a hospital, grocery store, or community center, could be denied an air quality permit under this language. The MPCA also believes the cumulative levels of effects and the demographic analyses would need to be implemented via rulemaking in order to clearly define what it means for a proposed project to, quote, cause or contribute to increased levels of environmental or health impacts. Additionally, the cost recovery mechanisms cited in House File 3146, which we are grateful for, would also need to be considered during a rulemaking. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify on this bill. The MPCA is committed to addressing environmental justice, and we look forward to continuing to work with the author and the community members supporting this bill to achieve our shared goals. We will be here for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next up, Megan Hassett, Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Megan Hassett. I'm the Midwest Clean Energy Advocate for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. UCS is a science advocacy organization with over 7,000 supporters in Minnesota. We're in enthusiastic support of House File 3146, as well as the amendments on rulemaking for air toxics and emissions reporting, air monitoring equipment, and community monitoring pilot programs. UCS is grateful for the leadership of Representative Lee in authoring this bill to protect frontline communities from cumulative impacts of pollution. We focus on effective use of science in making policy, and this bill is an example of how evidence-based decision-making can improve air quality and begin to bring justice to overburdened communities. In order to address environmental injustice, we must understand all the ways that communities are impacted by pollution, social and environmental stressors, and then prioritize protections for communities that have historically experienced disproportionate harm and are therefore most vulnerable to additional sources of pollution. With a strong definition of environmental justice area, and analyses of demographics and cumulative impacts, we can apply science and data to begin recognizing and tending to the harms of systemic discrimination and improve community health and well-being at the local level. The science is clear, the impacts of pollution have significant racial and economic disparities, from levels of pollution exposure to asthma rates and ER visits to premature deaths. These all vary starkly according to race and income, even as air quality improves overall. Sources of toxics and air pollution are historically cited in Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color and under-resourced communities, which already face systemic inequality in housing, health, and other aspects of society that make marginalized populations especially sensitive to the cumulative burdens of pollution. In a recent analysis, UCS found that Black Minnesotans are exposed to 65% higher concentrations of fine particulate matter air pollution from vehicles than the average exposure for all Minnesotans, while at the same time, white residents have an average exposure that's 9% lower than the average for the state. While this bill only pertains to permitted sources, as mentioned, the whole idea of cumulative impacts is that when Black and brown communities already experiencing disproportionate pollution and asthma rates from, say, vehicles because of residential segregation and highway siting, that additional pollution from a new industrial or power plant facility really matters. Minnesota state agencies publish data on the stark inequities of pollution burdens and related health impacts frequently. Yet the state still lacks a framework to begin to rectify how business as usual leads to these inequitable outcomes. This bill helps change that by incorporating all the factors that impact how vulnerable a given community is to pollution into decision making, so we can begin to alleviate rather than exacerbate these disparities. While this policy can't address income inequality and systems of racism, what it can do is give communities that are already struggling with structural inequities a reprieve from additional pollution. UCS supports the strong criteria to define environmental justice populations and ensuring that permitting processes include input from communities and analyses of cumulative impacts and demographics. This bill would create long overdue protections for the communities that experience disproportionate burdens of pollution and are often excluded from participation in these kinds of decision-making processes. UCS is also supportive of the public engagement provisions in the bill, that public hearings are held and all forms of public comment are made part of the public record upon which permit decisions are made. A strong process with strong engagement from impacted communities and careful attention paid to how these communities are sensitive to projects that impact air quality, given cumulative impacts of pollution and all the factors that shape who benefits and who is breathing the dirtiest air as a result, can help build a Minnesota where air quality doesn't depend on your zip code, your race, whether your community has a high percentage of non-English speakers, your income, or whether your community is located in Indian country. We ask this community to support HF 3146, and thank you so much for your time and the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Next up, Alejandro Caceres Aranda with Copal Min. Welcome to the committee and state your name for record.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to testify in your committee hearing regarding House File 3146. My name is Alejandro Caceres Aranda, and I'm currently a student intern here at Copal. I am also a junior at Minnesota State University, Mankato, studying both political science and Spanish. House File 3146 would make it so cumulative impact assessments will be taken before granting operation permits to polluting facilities that would benefit BIPOC frontline communities who are most disproportionately affected by pollution. I recently did some research using the GeoPlatform tool, which is a user-friendly interactive map that allows viewers to access housing data according to location and zip code. The website provides data on the following topics, such as climate change, energy efficiency, clean transit, sustainable housing, hills burns, and workforce development. In it, I found that in Blue Earth County, Mankato, there are more than one hazardous waste facilities present around North Riverfront Drive and around the North 2nd Street sector. It was found that in this sector, within a 5-kilometer radius of risk management, was within a five-kilometer radius of risk management plan facilities. This is alarming because many off-campus housing is located around that general area, which affects the student population from both Minnesota State University Mankato students and Bethany Lutheran College students as well. This is also around the downtown area of Mankato, which is home to many small locally owned businesses such as restaurants and bars that university students often go to, which has recently become home to new Latino and Muslim restaurants. In Mankato, the numbers tell us that residents of these sectors are low-income households that house students. Basically, pollution in low-income areas is further disadvantaging to individuals in Minnesota. This bill would improve quality of life for BIPOC folks living in low-income neighborhoods in the Twin Cities, especially around the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. But House File 3146 would also protect smaller town sectors from ecological disadvantage, such as my case in Mankato and other smaller university towns, which is home to many university students that are seeing a larger population of BIPOC students living in that area. It would also allow for cumulative impact assessment to be taken before granting operation permit to polluting facilities that would benefit frontline BIPOC communities disproportionately affected by the pollution. With that, I'll wrap it up. Thank you, Chris Hansen and members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to testify in your committee.
Thank you. Representative Lee, do you want to respond to some of the multitude of questions, or would you like to take questions?
I can take questions, Mr. Chair, and then I can provide my response afterwards.
Representative Wasler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have so many things to say, but I'll try and keep it short because I know we're limited on time. I want to thank the first two folks who testified, the folks who did the research on this. And I want to actually quote one of them in an article that talks about what we know, the data of what we know, that people of color are exposed to more of this pollution. And the quote is from Dr. Hill, and it says it's systemic. I'm not going to beat around the bush. This is the product of a long history of racism in this country. And he's right. And this is something that I think we as a state need to acknowledge and address. And this legislation that Representative Lee is bringing forward is one way for us to do that. I think it's really important, as we heard from other testifiers, you know, the percentage of Minnesotans, 51%, I think, was cited, of Minnesotans who are sort of exposed to higher than the levels that are recommended in terms of these air pollution toxics. So I just really want to thank Representative Lee for bringing this bill forward and continuing this work on this issue. I think it's really, really important that we do work on this issue. One question that I do have for Representative Lee, and perhaps someone from MPCA might be able to chime in too as well. I know that the MPCA had looked into less than 2 years ago, had looked into currently right now reporting emissions of hazardous air pollutants is actually voluntary. So it's not mandatory, and I know that's part of what we're trying to fix, but I'm wondering if, Representative Lee, if you could talk about if you've had conversations with MPCA about why that didn't move forward, because they had discussions about making that mandatory in the past and they decided not to do that. I don't know, Representative Lee, if you can address that. Otherwise, if there's someone, you know, perhaps Commissioner McDonald could chime in on that if you know more about it. Thank you.
Representative Lee or Mr. McDonald?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the MPCA. I've not talked to them about this in particular.
Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wasilek, thank you for the question. As I testified, we do believe a mandatory reporting structure is a prudent step for air toxics, and it is part of our rulemaking effort that would be required by the MPCA. So we appreciate the clarity in the bill about requiring that, and it's still something the MPCA is considering to move forward with, is that type of a rulemaking process to require it at a more frequent basis, which would definitely improve our understanding of air pollution there. As to your point as to why it didn't move forward, to be honest, our rulemaking team is quite strapped with a number of different rulemakings, and there's a queue, but we are still considering it as we speak. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would encourage, I understand that folks are busy, but I would encourage this one to take on some urgency here, because we know that this is a concern, especially in environmental justice areas. So just want to push that. Thank you.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, and I want to say thank you to all of our testifiers this morning. You know, it was really good to get all the different inputs and a lot of the data behind all this when we're talking about environmental justice. When looking at this bill and reviewing it last night and this morning, I think there's one part of the conversation that really hasn't been had yet, and really what this could have the effect on our job providers here in the state of Minnesota. You know, here in Minnesota, we have some of the strictest environmental regulations in the country, and I'm really proud of that, right? I represent part of the Iron Range, and we've been mining safely up there for 142 years. We're going to do it for another 142 years. You know, just yesterday evening, the president initiated the Defense Production Act. Hopefully that's going to get critical minerals starting to be developed here in Minnesota so we can actually start building these green technologies and making this state better and this country better, right? I think that's a really exciting thing. But unfortunately, I think this bill today would bring about a lot of problems. I think we would have a lot of responsible industries and businesses here in the state that would now be forced out because of these new regulations that would be brought in. And, you know, here in Minnesota, we demand the most out of our industries and our businesses, again, provide jobs. So my concern is, you know, when we're talking about environmental justice and equity, if we're going to force out these jobs in these industries because of aggressive regulation and permitting processes that make doing business in this state impossible, what we're going to do is we're going to force these jobs overseas. right, to places in Africa or places in China, right? And I've said it in this committee before, and I'll continue to say it again until we can have a bigger conversation on it. But then we're forcing the jobs and industry to places where there is no labor standards, where there is no environmental standards, right? And the idea that we're, you know, progressing with environmental justice and equity is mute, right? We're actually increasing the problem tenfold around the world. But, you know, you can say it's not in our backyard. And I think that's a huge problem. So, you know, to you, Representative Lee, I mean, I would love to hear your response to this, because I think this is just pushing the problem somewhere else and weakening our economy here in the state of Minnesota, rather than looking at this the other way, where we could try and work with industry to make this all better and showcase some American exceptionalism and bring about the world of tomorrow by working with industry rather than trying to shut them out.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Igo, for the feedback and the question. And I'll say this, you know, when you talk about job providers and jobs over here, I think that that's great. But at the end of the day, if we don't take care about the health and well-being of Minnesotans, there won't be workers for these jobs. And so I think that this is the most important piece to this legislation, is that we look for the health and welfare of the people of Minnesota. And, you know, when you go to, you know, the NPCA's website and to what Commissioner McDonald has said, is that, you know, the NPCA's, their primary duty is to protect the health and well-being of the state of Minnesota, the folks here, our environment. It's not to make it easier for industries to be able to do business. And, you know, the decision for businesses to move overseas and, you know, to go seek that labor, those are conversations that the business have to have themselves. What we're trying to do here is to protect the health and well-being of Minnesotans. And if they prefer profits over the health and well-being of Minnesotans, you know, that's their prerogative as a business. And so what I want us to do here is that we really need to focus in on protecting Minnesotans and their health above and beyond anything else before we consider, you know, some of these other impacts that, you know, may lead businesses to make the decision that will impact them.
Thank you for that response, Representative, and thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think the one thing that you're missing there, though, is when in your bill, you know, opening up this public permitting process for people to really get involved, and then, you know, the commissioner getting a lot more authority, you're extending permitting processes, and you're also allowing bad actors, I think, to really get into the conversation, right? When you have public comment, and this happens for every issue, there's people on the far right of things, there's people on the far left of things. And by opening this permitting process in like this, I think you're opening up to a huge amount of issues, and you're just going to stop that kind of progress. Because I think we do need to focus on doing things right. I agree with you there. But unfortunately, I think this bill puts up roadblocks where we're not going to be able to do anything here anymore. And that's why I'm against it today. So thank you for the conversation. I'm glad it was respectful. Again, thank you for all the conversation here today. And I hope in the future we can kind of work on things together about making sure we do it right here, with mining, logging, and et cetera, so we can have those job providers and we can make a difference here for our state and nation. Thank you.
Tim Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lee, I really want to thank you for your steadfast leadership on this issue. Your constituents and my constituents breathe the same air because our districts are right next to each other. And I can tell you that I am someone who has asthma. I am someone who has asthma that's exacerbated by air pollution. There were days last summer where I could not walk to my job that was half a mile away from my home because I would need to stop because I couldn't breathe. The number one reason why students in Minneapolis miss school is because they have asthma-related illnesses. So not only is this something that's just this isn't just a bill about the environment. This isn't just a bill about business. This is a bill about public health. And it's also a bill when we think about other things that I hear the business community talk about, which is workforce development. It's about having workers. When kids can't go to school because their asthma is too bad, that means their parents can't go to their jobs. That means that they're missing that day in school and they're not going to be as prepared for the jobs in the future. So I really think this is an important measure for every aspect of our society. And I am, are our researchers from the University of Minnesota still on?
Yes, we're still here.
Do you mind if I, Mr. Chair?
Representative Jordan, go ahead.
Thank you. I don't know if we can go back to some of these slides, but I was hoping we could go back to maybe that second slide about mortality. And really, if you could show some of the findings you found for the United States on mortality and air pollution and what that would mean for life expectancy for people of color, can you
Dr. Millay?
Unpack that a bit more.
Dr. Millay.
Sure. So I have the slide here. So I believe these are this was the slide you were asking about, and these were data from the Global Burden of Disease study looking at millions of lives lost or millions of premature deaths per year. This, and the first one was global, and then you were asking about the U.S. And so this isn't this data that I'm showing here isn't breaking it down by race, ethnicity. This is looking at everybody, but it's basically showing that, you know, there's a large number of deaths, somewhere between over 60,000 and maybe closer to 100,000, as Dr. Hill said, that premature deaths per year in the U.S. due to air pollution exposure. And then the sort of subsequent slides that we showed, and that Dr. Pratt also touched on, this is that those it's very well established that those exposures are disproportionately felt by communities of color.
Representative Jordan.
And then Professor Millay, would you say that would you say that Minnesota deaths would mirror the United States, or are there significant differences based on where in the United States? But do we see this same disparity based on race from air pollution in Minnesota that we see everywhere else in the United States?
Dr. Millay.
Yes, so we do. So I have another, let me quickly share a different slide here. So I have, let's see here. There we go. So I actually have that same image, if I can find it here really quickly. Here we go, it's in this one. Too many different versions. Here's the data for Minnesota. So this is, again, this one is not particularly broken down by race, ethnicity, but again, it's showing that Minnesota is no exception in terms of air pollution being a leading cause of illness and mortality, just like it is nationally. And Dr. Hill, in his presentation, did have some specific information about Minnesota in terms of the how those burdens are disproportionately felt by communities of color. And that's what he showed on this slide here, where I believe he can correct me if I state it incorrectly, but I believe the circles that were highlighting Minnesota, basically showing that people of color, which are in purple, are preferentially experiencing high levels of air pollution within Minnesota.
If Dr. Millay and Dr. Hill could provide the presentation so we could post them on the committee website for the public, so that would be helpful, if that's okay. Representative Jordan.
Thank you. And finally, I have one last question for Chair Lee. Chair Lee, are deaths from air pollution preventable, and is there something that we can do about it?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Jordan. I believe that this is one of the first steps for us to addressing some of the air pollutions that we are seeing in our communities. And, you know, in one of the particular proposals that I have in the amendment was for the local community monitoring program, so that we could start moving towards the step of actually measuring what's in our communities, so that we could work with our community members to find solutions to address some of these issues that are impacting us on a daily basis.
Representative Morrison, Representative Jordan, are you done?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee, for your leadership again.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to thank Representative Lee for his leadership on this just critically important issue to the future of our state. I appreciate Representative Jordan circling back, but I appreciate your comments about public health and the importance of that. And also bringing us back to some of the slides, I was listening to some of the comments thinking, maybe we need to repeat the entire presentation because it felt like it wasn't digested, the information that was relayed to us. It was pretty stunning, pretty concerning, pretty terrifying for the current and future state of the health of many Minnesotans. I think this is one of these moments. This is not about demonizing industry. This is about, as we learn more, we have to adjust. And the reason we're even having these conversations is because our regulations have failed us. They have been inadequate to protect the health of the people of Minnesota. So just wanted to circle back to that, take a moment to thank Representative Lee and the testifiers for sharing this critically important information with all of us this morning.
Representative Lee.
Thank you for that remarks, Mr. Chair. I don't really have anything else to add on that for right now.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, and then I'm going to just briefly respond to Representative Morrison. I think that there is so much benefit to all of us having the opportunity to come together, Republicans and Democrats, and look at this issue. And rather than suggesting that we have to repeat the presentation because someone had a question, I think that we could actually be a little bit more productive and try to figure out what is the best approach. Because, Representative Igel brought up some really important concerns. Job providers and legislators and scientists can work together to figure these kinds of problems out. And I think that it's critical that we ask some questions. And I am looking at, and listening to the chamber testimony today, and it sounds like those affected have voiced some concerns. And if we could address those things respectfully, rather than making some of these comments, I think that we could get a productive outcome. And that the real threat of these jobs leaving the state of Minnesota because of unanswered questions and a willingness to work together is really unnecessary. So if we could, I do have, like I said, a couple of questions. I jotted down. If we're going to be writing new rules, it would be really helpful if we understood fully as to how those rules are going to be written and what that process would look like. And maybe MPCA could elaborate looking at the bill language, and I'd have some more questions after that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee or Mr. McDonald?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to the MPCA on the rulemaking process.
Mr. McDonald.
Chair Hansen, Representative Heintzman, thank you for the question. We do think one of the areas for rulemaking that we'd flesh out has to do with definitions contained in the bill. Specifically, I would call folks' attention to the section that relates to what is the basis for the level of toxicity of emissions, as well as that decision point. And we'd want to undertake rulemaking to put a clear standard into rule for that definition of toxicity of emissions there. Toxicity could be something related to risk, as well as just like the overall toxicity of it there. So there's a piece of clarification there. Other aspects of the rulemaking, as I mentioned before, would address, which we're grateful for, that ability to capture costs and that cost recovery mechanism. Our costs for air permit application fees as well as emissions inventory fees are contained in rule. So we want to be able to do that as well. And then lastly, the decision for when the commissioner must either deny or approve a permit and that basis, putting out some rules around that so there's clarity for the agency and we can effectively and efficiently implement that, as well as provide some clarity to the regulated parties. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, Mr. McDonald, and I understand, at least my assumption is that you have a pretty clear understanding of where we are currently and how these, how current statute and rule regulates air permits. As I'm listening to you, the question that comes to mind is what would this rulemaking process that you're describing cover that isn't already covered under existing state or federal law? And that would I think be helpful as is another part of this conversation to know, are we reinventing the wheel here, or is this something that is absolutely not covered and is some kind of a blind spot in statute or rule here in Minnesota?
Mr. McDonald.
Chair Hansen, Representative Heinzman, thanks for the question. So this would cover a new area of regulation that has not been covered before, and additional requirements in our air quality programming and permitting process here. It deals with a class of compounds called air toxics. Currently, we work with EPA to regulate air toxics through hazardous air pollutants, which is a subcategory of air toxics, which can generally be a broader category. EPA defines 188 compounds as hazardous air pollutants and promulgates technology-based standards for those. So it requires specific industries to meet a certain level of control based on the technology adopted by that industry. The bill put forward by Representative Lee would address other air toxics, so it could expand beyond that hazardous air pollutants and also making sure that we have emissions limits and standards for that category.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McDonald, what could you describe for the committee what or why there is no federal, if I'm hearing you correctly, there's no federal rule or law that deals in this subject area, and no state law or rule that deals in this subject area. Why not?
Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, you know, I can't adjust the exact reasons why EPA has not promulgated similar rules or standards here. I know that in the promulgation of the Clean Air Act, we began addressing those hazardous air pollutants in those 1990 amendments and some of the opportunities there. I'd like to invite my colleague, Steve Pack, who is our air quality program manager, to maybe shed a little bit of light here onto that to the extent he's able. But again, it's tough to speculate on EPA's rationale for the decisions of their permitting projects.
Mr. Pack, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I am Steve Pack, and I am a manager of the air quality permit section at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mr. Chair and committee members, the Clean Air Act is what directs EPA to regulate air toxics, which they more formally call hazardous air pollutants, as Commissioner McDonald has indicated. And my understanding is that EPA has followed the requirements of the Clean Air Act in establishing those regulations, which are limited to developing those technology-based standards and going back and looking to see if there are any residual risks. And so what EPA regulations do not do is they do not focus on any specific facilities. And that is what this proposed statute would allow us to do, would be to focus on the risks posed by specific facilities.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate that last answer. That's helpful because it leads kind of to my next question, and it makes me wonder how or why, maybe again, why the language is written the way it is and why it only applies to Minneapolis, at least as I understand Section 23 and the A4 amendment. Representative Lee, it sounds like we're specifically looking at individual businesses, maybe, if I understood the testimony from MPCA. And then why the language and the scope is written as you have chosen, Representative Lee, to write it. It just is a question that, of course, I think people are going to be wondering, just like I am wondering. Maybe you could address that, Representative.
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heisman, I think you're referring to the Community Air Monitoring Local pilot program that I'm establishing. And so this is the pilot program, and this is the request that I had heard from my district of community members there. And so that's why I'm focusing on having the pilot program in Minneapolis for a monitoring program. But the bill overall, beyond that, section of the pilot program is for the entire state, and that's why we have identified environmental justice areas. And so in all senses, tracking the state, if you meet those criteria of what an EJ area is, then this applies statewide to those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a helpful clarification, and I'm glad that we had a chance to make sure that that's fully understood, so anybody that might have had a similar question is clear. So the discussion is focused, I guess, on the issue around the entire, or the application of this, if it were to become law, around the entire state. So, you know, Mr. Chair, I'm going to probably leave it there. We've talked about this bill for a long time, but I do think that there's so many unanswered questions. We could continue to talk about it for a lot longer. And if we do have that opportunity on the floor, you know, that might be a good opportunity for us to get a little bit better idea of what we're trying to accomplish here. And I look forward to that. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the chance to ask some questions.
To that point, Representative Lee, are you willing to work with Representative Heinzman on any of his concerns or any of the testifiers' concerns relating to the bill?
To that point, Mr. Chair, yes, I am willing to work with anyone that's interested in this and, you know, talking about the floor, Mr. Chair, like I mentioned in my opening remarks. Majority of the provisions in this bill were included in the 2021 House Omnibus Finance Bill. And it did go to the floor already, and now, you know, I'm just updating some of the content in there that I have heard from the MPCA and from community members, and then, you know, bringing in, you know, the air toxics. This is going back to the findings in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on water gremlin, talking about how back in 1985, they wanted to promulgate rulemaking on air toxics, but even 30 years to this day, and I think to Representative Wazlik's point earlier, that even to this day, 1 year after the report from the OLA, there has not been any rulemaking on air toxics. And so that's why we're bringing in that A4 amendment that was adopted earlier this morning. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm more than willing to work with anybody on this as we move forward in the process.
Representative Heitzman, there you go.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I'm sure Spencer, or Representative Vigo, is also happy to hear that, because it hasn't appeared that there has been a willingness to really make adjustments after it was brought to the floor last year. We're seeing basically the same language as we saw then. And so I'm glad that Representative Lee brought that up, and we'll see what the discussion is and if there really is willingness to make adjustments after having had the chance to talk about it on the floor last year. And then here we are again talking about it again. So we'll see. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's get Representative Backer in, and then we'll go to Representative.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. And this is to the author. And, you know, I heard that he answered some of my questions, I believe. He talked about reaching out to working with MPCA and the auditor. My question, Representative Lee, is who have you worked with in regards that would be affected if this bill did get passed? I know it's been some of this has been on the House floor. We've not seen anything that I'm aware of on the other chamber. But obviously, to get things through both chambers, and even, you know, we as reps have constituents that's going to be affected by this bill. Who have you worked with drafting this bill from the parties that would be affected if this would come into law? From an industry perspective, please.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Backer. Like I've mentioned before, this bill has been introduced at the beginning of last session. Actually, it's been introduced ever since I got into the legislature back in 2017. And the industries, if they, you know, want to really have meaningful dialogue on this, could have reached out, you know, from when it was introduced back in 2017, when it was included in the Omnibus Finance Bill last year, when I was reintroduced this year, and to some of the feedback that we heard from the industry today. I'm willing to address those, but, you know, are they actually having a good faith effort in reaching out to me to address this? And the feedback that I will have in crafting this bill is that I'm talking to frontline communities who are being impacted by air pollution every single day. And I think that's my, you know, my responsibility as a legislature to listen to the people of Minnesota and how they are being impacted by pollution.
And I appreciate that, Lee. I know it gets frustrating to work on these and so forth, but and I see the passion that you have on this to get bills into law. I know I'm working on an EMS bill, and I'm constantly reaching out to the stakeholders. So it's something that a professional recommendation to reach out to those affected parties so you can find an avenue forward instead of just being right now stuck on the House side. So that's all I have. I do appreciate your this dialogue. Thank you, Representative Lee and Chair.
Representative Lee, as an air breather, I appreciate on behalf of all air breathers the work you've done here to try to protect air breathers. It's important, I think members, I was struck by a different slide, and that was the lack of monitoring equipment or monitoring sites in our state. And I think back to the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989, and since that time, all the agencies have been working on water quality monitoring, and surface water and groundwater, even rainfall. We've set up networks throughout the state, and we focused on clean water. We haven't done the same for clean air. We have some sites, and as the testimony indicated, we focused on permits. We focused on clean cars. But the monitoring network, the assessment, and pollution prevention efforts are not equivalent to what we've done for clean water. And so it seems that we could invest in this time of a unique surplus in more air quality monitoring so that the air breathers, I guess that's all of us, could have a better idea of what the impacts are. We don't have a choice in the air we breathe. Unlike contaminated water, where maybe we can buy bottled water, having a choice for the air we breathe is not there. So I applaud Representative Lee for your effort here. Years of effort since 2017, you've tried working on this. So thank you for your work. And with that, if you have any closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the conversation on this. I really appreciate all members bringing forth some of their concerns. And like I've mentioned, I'm more than willing to work on this. And I think to one of the points that was brought up by one of the members around public engagement, I think that there's work for us to make sure that we actually have true, meaningful engagement on that from all interested parties. Why we're bringing this forward right now is that, my constituents and other frontline communities that we were identified in the presentation from the two professors for the University of Minnesota is that, communities of color are not part of the conversation about, how pollution is impacting them. And I think, Mr. Chair, to the larger conversation about why we are doing this and, what's going on at the federal level, in my opinion, we don't have anything to regulate air pollution or air toxins at the federal level, at the state level, because of industry. They have, understanding how hard it is for us to do the work here in Minnesota, and instead of industry coming to work with the bill author like myself to move this forward, they have decided to just come by and, offer feedback about their concerns, but not have meaningful engagement with us. And so I could only imagine, the industry and what they're doing to push back at the federal level around issues like this. And so, Mr. Chair, I really appreciate the conversation today, and to all members and members of the public, whoever wants to engage with me on this, so that we could actually move this one step forward to protecting the health and welfare of Minnesotans. I'm more than willing to work with everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 3146, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Next up, and I do have a question. I know that Representative Eklund has a bill up in another committee. Representative Eklund, do you want to go now, or so you're not double booked? Or
I just got done State Gov, Mr. Chair, so if you're ready for me, we can go.
Okay, why don't we go to Representative Eklund just to I'm going to bounce around here. Representative Heinzman, is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine, Mr. Chair. Thanks for asking.
Representative Eklund, House File 3311, Clean Water Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 3311 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing House File 3311, which is a one-time appropriation to prepare materials for Minnesota Assumption of Federal Clean Water Act 404 permitting. Minnesota has been studying assumption of this permitting authority for many years. In 2019, the legislature required state agencies to develop a report on the framework for assumption and cost estimates to pursue this authority. That report was submitted to the legislature in February. House File 3311 follows the report's recommendations by funding the development of materials necessary to submit an application for assumption to the US EPA. I have some testifiers here, Mr. Chair, members, to testify to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. First up, Les Lim with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Les Lem, the Wetlands Section Manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'll provide just a very brief overview of 404 assumption and then remain available for any questions. So I will share my screen at a very brief presentation here. Are you able to see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So first, I guess we'll just start with what are we talking about when we say 404 assumption? So Section 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act regulates activities in lakes, streams, and wetlands, and is currently implemented by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Minnesota. But Section 404 also allows for state implementation of an equivalent program, eliminating the separate federal permits in most waters. So in order to do that, the state must demonstrate that we have adequate jurisdiction, regulations, enforcement authority, the legal authority and staffing capacity to implement it, and compliance with certain standards and procedural requirements. So essentially, we take this look at the state regulatory programs, the overlapping federal regulatory program, and while they are overlapping, there are some gaps. So we look at where those gaps are, identify those gaps, close those gaps, and develop one comprehensive state program and the need for one permit rather than two separate permits from two separate programs. As Representative Eklund had alluded to, Minnesota has a history of exploring 404 assumption. That includes a feasibility study completed in 2017, some additional analysis of assumable waters in 2018, and more recently, some initial program development work and completion of a 2022 report on funding estimates. So why is Minnesota considering 404 assumption? Well, those interested in assumption have cited several reasons, including improved permitting timelines, faster processing, more responsive regulatory authorities, dealing with state and local authorities versus federal, reduced regulatory duplication and redundancy due to one permit instead of two, clarity and certainty on regulatory jurisdiction versus the federal waters of the U.S. So many of you may have may be familiar with some of the changes to the waters of the U.S. that seemingly are quite regular over recent years. Under 404 assumption, the state of Minnesota generally has a greater regulatory authority than the federal authority would, regardless of which waters of the U.S. rule is used. With a couple relatively minor exceptions or minor gaps that we would close, once those are closed, then permit applicants can be certain that their state permit conveys 404 authority without having to potentially go through a sometimes long and complicated jurisdictional determination process. And all those things lead to reduced costs for permit applicants. We've also got, certain like the Association of State Wetland Managers and certain other environmental organizations have cited more effective resource management drawing on localized expertise and better incorporation of watershed planning. So I think that's particularly important for Minnesota. Minnesota has invested heavily in watershed planning, and 404 assumption provides a greater opportunity to incorporate the goals of those watershed plans into the regulatory and mitigation programs of the state. And finally, it's congressional policy. It's in federal statute that the states implement the 404 program, and that's the origin of the 404 assumption process is that congressional policy. So I mentioned the recent 2022 report and some of the program development work that we've done recently. One of the things that we were aware of back when we did the 2017 feasibility study is that EPA had indicated that the state must have permitting authority in order for a state to assume. Well, currently under the Wetland Conservation Act, while it is a state rule, the local governments are making those permit decisions. So at the time, it was it looked like that may not be able to continue if we wanted to assume. But we worked very closely with EPA, and we've developed an implementation model that provides the state with the adequate authority for 404 assumption, but continues to utilize the significant network of expertise that we have in those local governments and continuing a significant role with the local governments. I mentioned, those relatively minor gaps in state jurisdiction. We've identified those and developed a plan for how those would be addressed if the state were to assume. We worked with the Pollution Control Agency to develop a process for water quality standards review. So currently the agency reviews federal permits. They review and certify them for compliance with the water quality standards of the state to ensure that those activities are in fact in compliance. So we developed a process with them where they would then review and certify state permits to ensure that all those permitted activities meet state water quality standards. We also identified several federal requirements that we could utilize online permitting systems, either entirely or partly, to implement, which would improve efficiency, not only for the implementers and at the state, but also for local governments and for landowners. And the 2017 feasibility study that I referenced did include some initial implementation costs. We had a range of costs based on what we knew at that time, and those costs have gone down. So the current estimate, I think we fully would expect that if we continue to work on this process, that estimate would continue to be refined. I think the more certainty we have and the more work we do to develop what the program would look like under assumption and know all the details, the greater certainty we have, the more accurate those cost estimates will become.
Okay, Mr. Lim, I think we're running out of time. So
okay, a couple slides left and that'll be it. So we have the 404 assumption, the 22 report included some cost estimates for the funding necessary to develop the application, essentially, and secure 404 assumption. Total of $740,000 between the three agencies, which includes some funds for Bowser to do work on behalf of both the DNR and PCA. And finally, just kind of where we're at in that process, we just completed the legislative report on funding estimates. We now are at the step of appropriation of the funds to assemble the remaining materials. And the estimates that you just saw, they do not commit the state to assuming, but what they do is provide the funds available to complete the program development work, assemble the draft application, identify the specific program and statute changes, final cost estimates, and then the legislature and the governor at that point would have a full set of information to be able to make an informed decision on whether to assume or not. At that point, then we would complete the necessary steps to develop the policies, submit the application, and approve and implement the program. So with that, if anyone has any questions, any of the members, I will remain available. Otherwise, you can contact myself or Executive Director John Jaschke directly at any time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Carol Andrews, PE, St. Louis County Public Works Environment Project Manager.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. This is Carol Andrews. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Proceed. Thank you.
I'm Carol Andrews, environmental engineer with the St. Louis County Public Works Department, and today I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Engineers Association, Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. These organizations have been involved with the 404 assumption for many years now. As you're probably aware, counties play an important role in implementing the state's Wetland Conservation Act, often serving as the local government unit. In addition to that, county public works departments are regulated parties that must obtain environmental permits to implement road, bridge, and trail and transit projects. My three points to make on the bill. First is we're very pleased with the work that Bowser has done and the other agencies that led to preparation of the 2022 report that Les just discussed. Several of the county representatives did participate in that process. In addition to providing the required cost estimates, it did flesh out a lot more details regarding how the state might best overcome some of the potential hurdles that were previously identified. Second, we support this proposed legislation. This would move the process into the final stage of information collection and deliberations that are necessary to make a fully informed go, no-go decision on 404 assumptions. The counties are committed to continue to work closely with state agencies on this, and that will include helping to provide direct and indirect cost information on benefits as well of the proposed action. Lastly, the County Engineers Association in particular supports efforts that ensure state wetland conservation agencies and water permitting agencies continue to look for opportunities to implement streamlining permitting procedures for transportation projects so that we can best make use of the infrastructure dollars that we've been allocated by the state and federal governments. Representative Eklund for bringing this legislation forward. That's what I have.
Thank you. Katie Smith, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Katie Smith. I'm the Director of Ecological and Water Resources at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. The DNR appreciates the direction and funding provided in the bill, which are necessary to continue the process and gather the information needed to make an informed decision on whether to apply for assumption of the 404 program. The recently submitted legislative report described some of DNR's current concerns, simply some areas of uncertainty regarding assumptions, such as technical complexities, public engagement needs, tribal interest considerations, and federal coordination, which have limited DNR's ability to provide greater accuracy for some of the funding estimates. And the DNR believes that prior to making any recommendations on whether or not to pursue 404 assumption, state agencies would need to collect this additional information. DNR also believes that we must check in with federal partners, tribes, and the governor's office as part of the decision-making on whether to make application. And the steps outlined in the recent legislative report also include approval by the legislature since statute changes are necessary, as well as appropriation of funding for future costs if the 404 program was assumed and implemented. The report also lists completion of agency rulemaking as necessary for 404 assumption. Now, the bill requires the agencies to apply for assumption of the program, and the DNR believes it's premature to require that step amidst the uncertainties and necessary approvals and required steps that we shared. And we'd be glad to work with the author on this bill as well as other interested parties. And thank you, and I'll be available for questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate Representative Eklund's work on this. Just a general comment, disappointed with the comments by the Department of Natural Resources. This train has been on a track for many, many, many years, actually, before either I or Representative Eklund came to this body. It's a longstanding need. Occasionally, and I know this is sometimes difficult for the agencies to deal with, but it's about time we moved ahead and got this done. And while obviously we want to make well-informed decisions, and hats off to the folks over in Bowser, they've obviously done their homework. It is still the legislator's prerogative, and the legislature's prerogative to direct the executive and the agencies what to do in this case. So I would suggest we continue to roll our sleeves up and move this thing forward. It's long, long overdue. I saw it 20 years ago, the kind of excess costs and headaches you have to go through at the local level with simply doing a relatively minor adjustment to a county highway or a township road, and the hoops you got to go through. So for the good of particularly rural Minnesota, we need to move on with this, and I would counsel the DNR to buckle up and stay focused on getting this done, as opposed to you can take umbrage of whether the legislature is going to decide whether we're going to do this or not, I see this as going forward. It may not happen this year, but we're really posed to get this done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eklund, any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And 12 years ago, when I was first elected to the Cochise County Board, and we had to delay a road permit because of the 404 assumption issue, I said, what in the world is this thing? And here, 12 years later, now we're finally getting a chance to maybe submit this to help, especially our counties that have so much pre-settlement wetlands in their holdings. So I think it's a good bill. I think it's time we get this done, and I appreciate the committee's support, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eklund renews his motion that House File 3311 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Next up, I'm going to hop around the agenda because we have members with testifiers who are not me. So we'll go to Representative Lippert, House File 2624, Property Assess Clean Energy Program Modified. Representative Lippert, will you move House File 2624 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House File 2624 to be laid over.
Representative Lippert, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Minnesota's Property Assess Clean Energy, or PACE program, has been providing low-cost financing for over 350 clean energy projects across the state, totaling $225 million of investment. And these projects stimulate private investment while reducing energy costs and environmental impacts, too. Currently, Minnesota farmers are eligible for utilizing PACE projects for energy-related projects such as installing solar panels. House File 2624 would expand the projects eligible for PACE financing to include water conservation projects and a broader set of high-quality long-term improvements to farmland. These projects could include drip irrigation systems, which are more efficient than sprinkler systems, projects that hold water back on the landscape, allowing it to naturally infiltrate the soil and slowing the volume of water entering our rivers and streams, fencing and water access for managed rotational grazing, natural landscape improvements that benefit pollinators and permanent perennial crops as well. Just as the current PACE program, applications go through an energy audit by a third party in order to be approved. These projects would go through an agronomic assessment by a third party as well. Farmers are experiencing heavier rainfalls and drier droughts, and this bill would provide them an additional financing tool for improving the resiliency of agricultural land in ways that also improve environmental outcomes. With me to testify today, at least my first testifier, Mr. Chair, is Pete Klein from the St. Paul Port Authority.
Welcome, Pete Klein, St. Paul Port Authority. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Klein. I am the Vice President of Finance for the St. Paul Port Authority. Several years ago, the Department of Commerce asked the Port Authority to take on PACE. It hadn't been active in Minnesota, and I said I'd take a good run at it, and it turns out it has several niches. And over this time period, we've produced quite a few projects. As Representative Lippert stated, over $225 million dollars, 350 projects, and that ranks us third in the nation behind California and Ohio. So, and last year we were recognized as the best PACE program in the country. We have joint powers agreements with about 70 of the 87 counties. We're doing projects all over the state, from a biotech project in Austin to a hotel in International Falls, from a housing project in Laverne to a manufacturer in Albertville and a restaurant in Ely, and numerous farms, hundreds of farms all over the state. So Cargill came to us a while ago asking if PACE could be used to finance agricultural land enhancements. Other states, California, for example, uses PACE to fund seismic retrofits, Florida, hurricane preparedness. And in fact, some of the newer states like Washington actually call their programs PACER, with the R standing for resiliency. In addition to the agricultural land enhancements, this bill would allow for quality water conservation to be eligible for PACE financing as well. And I think Minnesota might be the only state in the nation whose statute does not allow for water conservation to be used. It is a voluntary assessment. It's just a financing option. And we think that it would be good to improve the environmental impact of Cargill's supply chain and all of the agricultural supply chain. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Brad Jordahl-Redlin, Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program. Welcome to the committee and state your name.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Brad Jordahl-Redlin. I work at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, where I lead the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program. I want to provide some quick comments today from the agency. The first point being that this vehicle would be a complementary vehicle to existing mechanisms for supporting agriculture conservation, water quality conservation in Minnesota agriculture. So it complements those existing ones, but it's also unique and not duplicative of any of the instruments out there. So it's ultimately additive in terms of delivery of conservation services to the state. I would note that the program also, as has been stated, does provide for validation of the services provided through practices that are funded, as do existing PACE projects for their energy effects. The viability of the practice itself and the outcome of it through egg conservation is a component of this provision as well. The department appreciates that. We support it through one example we can provide, and that is the work of our water quality certification program, which independent analysis from the Farm Business Management Program at Minnesota State Colleges shows a 20% or on average $40,000 higher net income for farms certified with their heightened conservation performance over those farms who are not. So a financing system for projects like this, we believe, shows to be money well spent, is cost effective. And so we stand to work with the author in providing additional options for agriculture in the state to perform higher conservation. With that, I'll conclude.
Representative Lippert? I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Wassel.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I believe you have an A1 amendment. Will you move that amendment and describe it for the committee?
I will move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair, and it's a relatively short amendment. It redefines productivity as profitability. They are not the same thing. Profitability includes many more things rather than focusing solely on production. It states that land and water improvement does not include drainage. So we're not using the PACE program to improve drainage. And then it provides for soil health and water quality components in there. So I think it strengthens the bill, and I would ask for your support.
Any questions for members about the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, I would encourage support of the amendment too. This is just a further focusing of the language to make sure that supporting the projects that we want eligible, those that are holding water back on the land, allowing it, allowing that water to infiltrate the soil and slowing the volume of water into streams and rivers. So I support the amendment.
Representative Hansen has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. We will now move to broader questions from members if members have questions about the bill as amended. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Overall, I think that the bill makes some sense and it should probably continue to move through the process. I do have a question that was actually sent to me, and maybe Representative Lippert, you could help explain, because this, otherwise known as this PACE program, Property Assessed Clean Energy, is I believe what that stands for. But of course, the discussion today has focused primarily on the water projects that would come as a result of the language moving forward. So, you know, if you could expand and explain why what is otherwise dealing with energy is being used to work in the project areas that have been discussed today, that would be helpful.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heintzman. Peter Klein, in his testimony, mentioned that Minnesota is one of the few, if not the only, states in the country that doesn't have eligibility for water conservation-related projects. So states are using the PACE financing mechanism in a variety of ways, especially as we're starting to seek to address resiliency issues related to the impacts of climate change. And so for us, flooding is a major issue. That's primary concern of mine. I'm in a community that's experienced multiple floods in the last 10 years on the Cannon River, and we need water held back on the landscape, and this would be another financing tool for farmers to do that. I'll turn it to Peter Klein to say a little bit more. He has more to add.
Mr. Klein?
Madam Chair, the PACE definitely has evolved throughout the country to address situations within that are unique to those areas. So I mentioned Florida with hurricane preparedness, California with seismic retrofit, and in the Midwest, in Nebraska, they've addressed tornado preparedness in other areas. PACE is a voluntary assessment. It is a voluntary way to finance these projects. And the delayed payment and the fixed term of that payment is a very attractive way to finance these projects. And so PACE has evolved throughout the country. And that's why when Cargill did come to us, I said, well, it has evolved into other areas other than just energy. And we believe that this would significantly help the environment.
Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it is maybe not a workable option to consider changing the name, just for clarification for those that might look at that definition, property assessed clean energy, and be confused. But things come down from the federal level, and here we are. So thanks for helping to try and explain why it is functioning the way it is in spite of its title. Thank you for that. And I guess we can move on.
Any further discussion? Any other questions for members? Not seeing any hands go up. Representative Lippert, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time and consideration of the committee today. Also, the work that Chair Hansen and I have been doing on the language for a while as well, to make sure that this bill is doing exactly what we want it to do. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee.
Representative Lippert renews his motion that House File 2624, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Chair Hansen, I know we've jumped around on the agenda a few times today. Did you have one of the bills in particular you wanted to take up next?
Let's do the lands bill last because we have to take that off the table. And as long as you're chairing, why don't we do House File 4736?
All right. Representative Hansen, so you said 4736. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move that House File 4736 be recommended to be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Representative Hansen, I believe you also have the A2 Authors Amendment. Would you like to move that amendment and explain it briefly for the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A2 Authors Amendment. The A2 Authors Amendment adds some conditions on affordability, provides definition for and an appropriation for lead service lines. We have talked a lot about lead service lines and it's been discussed in multiple committees, but we don't have the definitions. And, you know, I just go back to Mr. Quillis's discussion on one of the earlier bills about needing definitions. And so it's important to get them into law. So that is the A2 amendment, and I'd ask for your support.
Representative Hansen moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the bill as amended, House File 4736, is looking at both the drinking water and wastewater, as well as lead service lines. With the federal a law coming in for infrastructure, there is a great deal of opportunity, but our laws have not kept up either with incorporating greenhouse gas emissions or different types of criteria that the federal government actually requires. We have focused solely on affordability, and there are other conditions looking at demographic changes, poverty, et cetera, that can be included. So it provides that as well as the definitions I discussed earlier with an appropriation for lead service lines. And I have testifiers.
First on the list of testifiers is Dana Vanderbosch from the MPCA. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dana Vanderbosch, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Water Policy and Agriculture at the MPCA. And thank you for the opportunity to provide the MPCA's feedback on House File 4736. I'd like to first note that our staff are still reviewing this bill for potential impacts. However, MPCA certainly shares the goals of encouraging energy efficiency and incorporating climate resiliency in wastewater and stormwater infrastructure. There are some projects on the project priority list that we see as examples of resiliency projects, such as those that address infiltration and inflow and prevent the wastewater overflows that we see occurring often during wet weather years. So it's a very, very common occurrence. Some wastewater facilities use quite a bit of energy, and they are interested in improving energy efficiency. So House File 4736 is a good example of creative thinking to help us incentivize opportunities so communities can meet their resiliency and sustainability goals. With that said, there are a few areas that we want to carefully consider. First, adding in these two criteria into the scoring and ranking of projects for the project priority list needs to be carefully considered to ensure that there aren't unintended consequences. There's a lot of aging infrastructure, and we're concerned that some projects would not be able to meet the climate and greenhouse gas criteria despite a desperate and legitimate need for funding. In addition, the bill contains an interim measure of reviewing the current PPL and providing recommendations to the Public Facilities Authority that prioritize the projects based solely on the climate resiliency and the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. This would shift the program priorities away from projects that first and foremost provide a water quality benefit. And this has always really been the cornerstone of the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. At this time, cities are receiving new effluent limits for parameters that are difficult and very costly to treat, things like phosphorus, chloride, sulfate, and they're depending on PFA funding to help them upgrade their facilities so they can ensure that we are meeting our joint water quality goals. Lastly, with the passage of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, we are anticipating an influx of federal dollars, and with that will come a lot of new project applications from communities that must be reviewed in a timely manner to allow us to take advantage of this funding. Changing criteria right now would mean embarking on a rulemaking and then developing new processes and guidance. and that would divert staff time and could lead to missing deadlines, which could mean missing out on funding. So in closing, we've not finished reviewing the bill language, but we certainly appreciate the goal of the legislation and agree that incorporating criteria like those in the bill would advance community goals for reducing energy costs and allowing communities to develop greater resiliency to avoid incidences of localized flooding and wastewater overflows. And we look forward to working with the author more on the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to provide testimony today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Jeff Freeman from the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. You could introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. I wanted to talk about some serious concerns I have about changes in the bill to the PFA WIF grant program. The WIF program is the purpose of the WIF program is to help cities repair and replace aging infrastructure that would otherwise be unaffordable. The WIF program measures affordability by comparing the average system cost per household to the median household income of the community. Affordability is largely tied to economies of scale. Smaller cities have a smaller user base to spread the costs over. Therefore, typically WIF grants have gone to smaller communities. For comparison, an average household in the metro area pays about $29 a month for wastewater service. To be eligible for WIF grants, cities typically would have to have average costs in the $50 to $60 a month range, and many smaller communities pay even more than that. Cities generally pay for these projects through user charges that are charged proportionately to all users. Grant assistance to larger cities is diluted by the fact they have a larger user base. Because of that, grants tend to have a larger impact on the cost in smaller communities than larger ones. In some cases, a city may assess project costs to a smaller area of the city, and in those cases, we do work with the community to determine WIF eligibility based on that smaller user base. But in general, the proposed changes would essentially throw out the existing affordability criteria and replace it with broader demographic measures. I believe this would result in less effective targeting of WIF grant funds to cities and their residents that most need the assistance to maintain their basic water infrastructure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a few other folks here to help answer questions, and at this point, we'll move to member questions. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this over. And then this is to Mr. Freeman then. Mr. Freeman, you know, according to the implementation guidance that we have received from the feds on the IIJA funding, they have determined that we need to consider, you know, beyond just the medium household income. And so can you talk a little bit more, you know, according to our definition of affordability right now, do we only consider medium household income or do we measure other indicators too?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lee. First of all, I need to point out that the WIF program is a state-funded grant program. So federal requirements do not directly apply to the WIF grant program. In PFA statutes, there is a cross-reference between the from the federal principal forgiveness grant funds that are available through the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. They do reference the WIF affordability criteria. So there is that cross-reference, but WIF grants are state-funded. Federal requirements do not apply.
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, you're muted.
Sorry, I'm roll calling in another committee and I am not, I'm not able to, sorry, was there another question, Representative Lee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And so Because of that cross-reference, then, Mr. Freeman, then are we, can I ask you, are we in compliance with the Clean Water Act?
Lewick is present. I'm in another committee chairing. Sorry about that.
Sorry, Madam Chair. So are we in compliance with the Clean Water Act, then, Mr. Freeman, if we are not considering, you know, some of the other criteria based on unemployment data, population trends, and others, data determined by the state, if we're doing the cross-reference to the WIF program? And do we need some clarification on that there?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, we are in compliance with federal requirements. Our intended use plan each year lays out how the WIF criteria are used to satisfy the federal requirements for affordability-based grants and other factors. We now have the new IGF federal infrastructure funding that we are working with EPA to determine if other measures might be needed. But my understanding is the federal act does not have specific requirements. It has suggestions and ideas for factors that should be and could be considered. We'll be working with the EPA to determine whether we need to make changes. But at this time, I'm not aware that we need to make any changes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll forward this to Mr. Strohmeyer to send to all members. So according to the EPA guidance that came out on March 8th, and I'm quoting right now, the CWA, the Clean Water Act, Section 603(i)(2), requires states to develop affordability criteria that will assist them in identifying applicants that would have difficulty financing projects without additional subsidization. The Clean Water Act, Section 603(i)(2)(a), requires that criteria be based on income, unemployment data, population trends, and other data determined relevant by the state. And so this is coming directly from the feds, and I'm concerned, Madam Chair, that if we just go off with a WIF statute where it doesn't consider unemployment data and population trends, that I think that quite possibly we might not be in compliance with them. And additionally, you know, in the guidance from the feds, they have mentioned that, you know, there are communities out there that are in larger system, like my community in my district, where we are in the city of Minneapolis system. But if we were just to look at, you know, median household income, we would not get any, my residents, you know, in my district would not get any of the services or benefit from these federal dollars. But, you know, if they are, you know, if we were looking at disadvantaged communities, if we look at the other criteria, may fall under that. And so, Madam Chair and Chair Hansen, I really appreciate you bringing this forward, that this is an ongoing conversation. And I'm glad that we'll bring this on to capital investment for us to have further discussion on this, too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I just want to apologize if I interrupted anybody when I roll called in the other committee. I was playing mute-unmute game, and I made a mistake there. I'm Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of questions. I'll start with Mr. Freeman. And I guess, you know, hearing your testimony and quite honestly, hearing Assistant Commissioner Vanderbosch's testimony today, it's to some extent a bit alarming. And I'm wondering, Mr. Freeman, did the bill author call you or communicate with you or ask you what's going on, or seek any advice from you on this bill? You know, I'm listening to Representative Lee's comments, and it sounds like there's a whole lot of questions that could have been addressed during the authorship of this bill. Was any of that communication happening between your office and the bill author?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Heinzman, no, the first time I saw this WIF language was last night. We haven't had any discussions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Freeman, it sounds like, Kevin, if you've just seen it last night, is it possible that this language could even further impact this subject area than you've been able to ascertain thus far? In other words,
Should I be more concerned or less concerned, being as this language just came forward last night for an opportunity for you to look at it?
Mr. Freeman?
Madam Chair, Representative Heinzman, the new language introduces some new metrics that potentially could be considered as part of the federal principal forgiveness funds. Again, I stress there's a difference between the state WIF program and the federal principal forgiveness funds. And be happy to have Heinzman? More discussion about that.
Representative Heinzman.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Mr. Freeman was still talking when you started to, so I couldn't hear what he said.
Yep, sorry about that. My internet froze over here when he was still talking. Mr. Freeman, if you want to just repeat the last
thing. I just want to, just making the point that the state WIF grant program is different from the federal principal forgiveness funds, which do have some additional federal requirements. We've been using federal principal forgiveness funds for at least 7 or 8 years with the cross-reference to the WIF grant program, along with some explanation in our intended use plan that meeting household income, population trends, unemployment data are used in our determination of how to use the federal principal forgiveness fund. So we believe we are in compliance. We've been doing this for a number of years. There are some new factors introduced in the language. I'd be happy to talk about are there ways to incorporate those, but I'd be very concerned about just totally getting rid of the household affordability criteria.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Freeman, that's really helpful. I appreciate you highlighting that for the committee. I do wish that some of those questions might have been presented to you earlier so that maybe we wouldn't be having to go through this at the final moments. I understand we're at deadlines this week, Representative Hansen, but at the same time, it does seem like it would have been prudent. This program, you know, under PFA is absolutely critical across the state of Minnesota and affects communities like mine in a huge way. So being that there's the questions that we have, I can't help but, kind of try to vet these things out a little bit. So if I'm reading correctly and I understand correctly, we're modifying chapter 446A, which are PFA statutes. And if I understand the jurisdiction of this committee correctly, that would be outside of our area. So I'm assuming that this is gonna be heard industrial ed, economic development. And if it's not, you know, maybe there could be some kind of explanation. I'm hoping that it could be more thoroughly vetted and have a chance to continue to be discussed, especially if it might show up in an omnibus bill. I didn't see, or I missed where the bill was going. So if that could be clarified, that would maybe be helpful.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Heinzman, the bill is going to capital investment, which has a longer timeline, as you know, for deadlines, and it will be heard there because of both IIJA funds and a potential for state funding with the bonding bill or cash in the bonding bill. It is here because we are an environmental committee, and we're sending it there where it's got longer time for input. I would note that part of the amendment that went on related to the Metropolitan Council is within our jurisdiction, and it is likely that that will stay within our committee potentially as it moves forward. Just one other thing, Representative Heinzman, maybe to answer one of your other questions. No, Representative Lee focused on the federal guidance, which came out on March 8th. And with the federal guidance, the world continues to change. And the agencies also sometimes, well, just the easiest thing to do is keep doing what you're doing, isn't it? The easiest thing to do is to do the status quo. But over the years, the status quo may develop inherent biases in them. And so what this does in the amendments is it provides choices for prioritization that help define the affordability, but also changing demographics
as are required in the federal requirements. So I hope that Representative Lee can get that federal guidance document to Mr. Strohmeyer so it can be posted or sent out to the committee members, and the discussion can continue in the bonding committee if the bill passes there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Respectfully, Representative Hansen, you and I both know that Representative Lee's committee is not a policy committee. And here we are in the final hour putting forward a bill that MPCA is able to look at last night. It has no Senate author. I know that's always irritating when we bring that up, but all of these questions begin to raise further questions. And just suggesting that somehow the federal rule change is justification for completely going around a process that works because of inherent bias is, I don't even know how to respond in some ways, because it's like, I mean, do we do things the way we've done them for no reason, or do we have this process for no reason? I think we would all agree that it's helpful to have as many eyes on something like this as we could have. And just sending this on to a finance committee when it's full of policy is raising more questions than it's actually answering. You know, I understand maybe what you're saying and what your strategy might be, but I certainly don't agree with it, and it should raise a lot more questions in the public. That's just my two cents.
Representative Hansen, did you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, the underlying bill with greenhouse gas emissions and climate resiliency are also criteria that are being recognized at the federal level. So we need to evolve. We need to change to meet the times and the requirements. Again, the easiest thing to do is to keep doing the same thing. This bill is here now and will go to Representative Lee's committee. You know, frankly, the other body took February off and didn't have hearings in the environment. So we are doing the work. And obviously, we're having this discussion right now. This is important policy. And I think we just heard members talk about the legislature's prerogative to provide direction for the executive. And as I've said before, we are the legislative branch, and we do provide the policy. So here's the opportunity and the funding to do that.
Representative Blewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I was probably the individual that the chair was referring to. And certainly the legislature does provide the direction to the agencies and executive. However, you know, there's a well-worn phrase that we've heard over and over the years since I've been here, which is not nearly as many as the chair. But I seem to remember the phrase, in the dark of night. Let me say that again, in the dark of night. And I find it pretty disrespectful to the public in general that we would jam this level of complication. And I don't disagree. We need to work on this. But to expect that the agencies would have to provide their input to this committee and give them one blink literally after midnight to appropriately respond is certainly what I would call a definition of doing business in the dark of night. And I think that we probably all owe the agencies an apology for putting them on the spot this quickly without really ample opportunity to flesh out a area that there's no disagreement that we need to tackle this and work on it. But there are appropriate ways to do things, and certainly not in the dark of night. That's my comments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen, did you have a response, or can I move to Representative Beckerfin?
It's a sunny day right now, and we're debating it.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was also going to point that out. It's 10:49 in the morning. We've been here over 2 hours. And I just want to remind folks, you know, as we talk about the precedent and how we do things and the process, that not that long ago, in 17 and 18, we had omnibus bills come forward with multiple provisions, brand new items that we had never discussed in committee. And I personally would much rather discuss the bills in committee like we are right now, and maybe focus on what's actually in the bill. It would be great. And I think that's what we're doing. And it was noticed, and the public is watching us now, which is great, in the sunshine. And I think I just want to remind folks that, you know, if we're going to get into, you know, the process questions, that not that long ago, the previous chair of this committee would bring items forward in an omnibus bill that never even got vetted prior to deadline. So I think I'm glad that we're having this discussion today, although I would guess people would like to actually go out in that sunshine if soon enough. I think we've got one more on the agenda today. So I just want to remind people about that as we talk about process and different ways to run this committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate it. Now, when I was younger, my mom would always say to me, two wrongs don't make a right. As a past mayor of City of Browns Valley, we really need to hear more from cities. I mean, my current mayor of a community is working right now, has no knowledge of this, and this has a huge impact, especially when we give such changes to how we're doing what we're doing in this bill. So that's my concern. We need a full vetting. I would agree with Representative Becker Finn. We need a full vetting process. This was just filed here yesterday, and this has major impact to a small community. So I am concerned, just, and we've heard from other members of how this is going, and this needs to be fully vetted, and kind of heard that it's kind of been, the Senate's being blamed for this. Well, they just got his also. So I think we need to be adults in the room and say, hey, let's pull this back instead of shoving this through. That's my two cents. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping that somebody might bring in the cities to get some feedback from those folks and what the impact might be in their communities. And if there's somebody from that group, that would be terrific to get some more feedback, and we could continue to debate what's actually in the bill and what is happening along with the process.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to highlight what we're actually talking about here, and that is using the best and most current data, recently published data from the United States Census Bureau or the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This data is available through the state demographer. You can have a map made looking at these things. But item number one, 20% or more residents have income below the federal poverty levels. Item number two, ATTRACT has a United States Centers for Disease Control or Prevention Social Vulnerability Index greater than 0.80. Item number three, the upper limit of the lowest quintile of household income is less than the state's upper limit of the lowest quintile. Number four, the housing vacancy rate is greater than the state average. And number five, the percent of the population receiving Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP benefits, is greater than the state average. So the criteria are three of those five that help on that affordability and looking at demographics and changes in population so that these programs can be delivered equitably.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman, I don't believe we have a rep from like the Association of Cities or anything like that on the call today, but if you have other questions.
Madam Chair, no one is here from League of Minnesota Cities or anybody from LMC or anyone that is somewhat in the crosshairs of this language here to testify and to speak to this bill?
I don't see anybody on the Zoom call from the League of Minnesota Cities or other city organizations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm assuming that being the case, that they likely were in the same position as the rest of us. And Representative Blewick is completely right in pointing out that this bill just showed up in the dead of night. And it's fair to point that out because that was the case. And typically the people that would have an opportunity to look at the language and offer feedback, it appears, haven't been approached, haven't had a chance to offer that. So I think it's fully reasonable to question the way that this bill has come to this committee and to further question where the bill is going. It's not going to a policy committee, it's going to a finance committee. And we can explain it any which way that the bill author wants to, but that's beyond bizarre. And so I hope that we can continue to address that without being told that somehow it's out of line or isn't a discussion of the bill language. And in my line of questioning, I had to go to MPCA very specifically and ask questions. And I guess I'm going to have to continue to do that because, you know, the folks that I would like to get feedback from probably don't even know what's that this bill is being discussed, or if they missed it, are still trying to figure out what the bill does, being as it was only introduced last night. And I have to also echo Representative Backer's point that to suggest that somehow the Senate has dropped the ball after this bill was introduced last night, again, it's really unreal, the hearing that we're having today. I'm sorry, Representative Hansen, but it's just too odd. It has to be addressed.
Representative Hansen?
I would encourage members to that? And encourage members to read the bill as amended. And I would renew my motion that House File 4736 as amended be recommended be referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 4736 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Vice Chair Wasilick.
Wasilick, aye.
Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Heintzman?
No.
Heintzman, no. Representative Akam?
Aye.
Akam, aye. Representative Ackland?
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer?
No.
Backer, no. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Ackland? Representative Ackland. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Green.
No.
Green, no. Representative Igo.
Igo, no.
Igo, no. Representative Jordan.
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Representative Keeler.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Representative Lewick.
Lewick, no.
Lewick, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, no.
Nelson, no. Representative Tice. Representative Tice. Checking one more time for Representative Ackland.
Tice, no.
Tice, no. Representative Ackland. Madam Chair, there are 10 ayes and 8 nays.
The motion prevails and the bill is on its way to capital investment. Last on the agenda for the day is the lands bill. Representative Hansen, this is House File 3916. Do you want to make the motion to take the bill off the table?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I should note that Representative Sandell was here, but has had to go to another commitment. I will move that House File 3916, as amended, be taken from the table.
Representative Hansen has moved that House File 3916, as amended, be taken from the table. The clerk will take the roll.
Vice Chair Wasilick.
Wasilick, aye.
Loswick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Heintzman?
Aye.
Heintzman, aye. Representative Akam?
Utterweaver.
Aye.
Akam, aye. Representative Backer?
Aye.
Sorry, Representative Ackland?
Ackland, aye.
Got
Ackland,
it.
Aye.
Representative Becker Finn?
Aye.
Representative Ackland?
Aye.
Aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Representative Green?
Aye.
Representative Igo? Representative Igo?
Igo, no.
Igo, no. Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Jordan, aye. Representative Keeler?
Aye.
Keeler, aye. Representative Lee?
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lippert?
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Representative Lewick?
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Tice?
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye. Madam Chair, there are 18 ayes and one nay.
House File 3916, as amended, is taken off the table.
Madam Chair, I will move that House File 3916, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
House File 3916, as amended, is now back before the committee. Representative Hansen, to the bill as amended.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the lands bill that was laid on the table in a previous meeting. There was some disagreement between St. Louis County and the DNR. As it was laid on the table, we also talked with the minority party to see if they had any additional lands provisions. There were a couple from the majority party and one from the New Republican Party. So I would move the A6 amendment, which includes each of those provisions, and maybe Ms. Damon could go over that.
Ms. Damon, if you can introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Damon. I'm the Assistant Director of the DNR Division of Lands and Minerals, and I'll talk about the provisions in the A6 amendment. Lines 1.3 and 1.4 amend a provision of the A2 amendment that grants the county auditors the authority to convey conservation easements on tax forfeited land. The addition in the A6 amendment provides for review and consultation with the DNR before the auditor conveys the conservation easement. The DNR and the counties work together to develop this amendment to address the DNR's concerns about the original bill language. Lines 2.2 through 2.5 amend Minnesota Statute Section 394.36, Subdivision 4. Provision was based on an original bill by Representative Draskowski, and the DNR and the representative worked together to address some initial DNR concerns. The amendment authorizes a county by ordinance to permit an expansion or impose upon nonconformities reasonable regulations to prevent and abate nuisances and to protect the public health, welfare, or safety. This amendment mirrors a provision for municipalities that is already in Minnesota Statute Section 462.357, and the DNR has no concerns about this amendment. Lines 2.8 through 2.32. This is from Representative Grassel, and it authorizes Beltrami County to sell certain tax forfeited land by private sale. This will enable the county to resolve a trespass. The DNR reviewed the proposed sale and has no concerns. And finally, lines 2.34 through 3.5 authorize the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, with the approval of the Land Exchange Board, to exchange certain land with the City of Rosemount for an equal amount of the city's land, regardless of a difference in market value. The DNR has no concerns about that provision. That concludes my remarks. I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Damon. We're going to take questions on the amendment, on the A6 amendment. If there are any member questions, please feel free to raise your hand. Not seeing any hands raised. Representative Hansen has moved the A6 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the A6 amendment is adopted. Now we'll move to questions for members on the bill as amended. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to go ahead and ask my question on the amendment specifically, but it seemed like we can go ahead and move on because it's probably the amendment where we're going to focus as it relates to questions on the bill anyway. I'm trying to understand, because it sounds like the amendment allows DNR to weigh in before easements are allowed. It just seems like a strange idea to put in statute, and it may, you know, maybe DNR likes this, but I'm wondering, you know, there could of course be circumstances where a county is working to move a tax forfeited property along the process into another use, and you know, putting this in statute leaves me kind of wondering, and maybe there's nothing to worry about, but it just kind of gives me pause. And if we could maybe have a little bit more understanding of why that needs to be statutorily addressed and why the amendment was brought forward, Representative Hansen, it would be helpful.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe this was originally a Representative Eklund provision, and St. Louis County worked with the DNR. So I would defer to their compromise effort if there's someone, Ms. Damon, to explain deeper, or St. Louis County, or Representative Eklund.
Ms. Damon, is that something you can take?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heinzman, there are similar provisions for review of tax forfeited land. For example, the DNR has statutory authority to review proposed sales of tax forfeited land that border water. That is a major responsibility of our lands and minerals staff. This provision, the original A2 amendment that was a county language, authorized the county auditor to enter into conservation easements on tax forfeited land. And those are typically for ecosystem services. And as you are aware, the DNR is the state entity that has responsibilities for state minerals. And our concern was that there may be state minerals underlying those tax forfeited parcels that could be impacted by the conservation easements. And this would give us an opportunity to review the proposed conservation easement and weigh in with the counties, provide information about mineral potential, et cetera, to the counties before they enter into that conservation easement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Representative Hansen, good job. My hat is off. That's a great amendment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Steve. It's a bright day.
Representative Heinzman, did you have any further questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other member questions? Not seeing any hands going up. Representative Hansen, any closing remarks?
I renew my motion that it be laid over.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3916 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Chair Hansen, did you have anything you wanted to share with committee members before we wrap up?
Yes, Madam Chair, I did want to just kind of reflect for a moment. We are going to be compiling or preparing the omnibus bill. Monday, in Ways and Means, there will be the LCCMR recommendations bill will be up. Those two bills will be traveling separately. But I wanted to, this is the last hearing before we venture into the omnibus process, I wanted to reflect really on, the legislature as it has been for the last 10 years, on the current lines that exist, the districts that we all represent. And during that 10 years, we've had a variety of approaches to environmental protection. We have spent a lot of time, focusing on environmental protection as acquisition. And I can remember the debates at the early part of the decade of how much land we would buy, what PILT was, and that we needed to buy land in order to save it. And then we had a period where we talked a lot about agency overreach, where there was individual issues with agencies that became bills, and we spent quite a bit of time on that. We heard today about speed. Throughout those 10 years, we talked about faster and faster and faster on permits. And I'm hopeful that folks have noticed that we have tried to change that debate in these last few years, that there are issues that cannot be resolved with speed in the environment. There are issues that cannot be resolved with acquiring property. There are issues that cannot be resolved by just focusing on the agencies. Air quality concerns, individual toxics, Vice Chair Wozlik, the issues with water gremlin that we've been dealing with, I think highlight the concerns related to individual contaminants. And I'd ask the committee, as we reflect and go into this, to realize or to think about the future. And how do we deal with environmental protection? And environmental protection means education, incentives, regulation, and an effort by all of us, as well as those that are regulated. There are contaminants, and there are contaminants at the beginning of the decade that we didn't think about, microplastics, neonicotinoids. But the PFAS effort was looked at as a court system, as in litigation. We now know that emerging issues will continue to be here and that we have to adapt and evolve. And that evolution is a healthy and normal process. Maybe it's not evolution, maybe it's metamorphosis. Maybe there's a transformation that's involved in how we look at things differently and how do we solve problems differently, and that there are different problems that need to be resolved differently. So are we perfect in moving forward? No. But I think we're on a different journey than we were 10 years ago. And our districts have changed. All of our districts have changed during that 10 years. So we will continue to have work to do. And I'm hopeful we can find some common ground, despite our differences, to recognize there are differences. And it's going to take different approaches. We're dealing with different problems than we have in the past. And if we look at that, I think we can all do better. And I would ask for your support.
All right, with no further business before the committee today, we are adjourned.